listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers, coming to you from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Vermont lost two extraordinary poets in September, Leland Kinsey and David Budbill. I never had the pleasure of interviewing Leland Kinsey, but I will be posting links to other interviews and resources on Write the Book's website. I did interview David Budbill twice. He was a wonderful person and a friend. Today on the show, I'm replaying the conversation I shared with David Budbill in 2011 after the publication of his collection, Happy Life. The following is from David Budbill's website. David Budbill died peacefully at his home in the early morning hours of September 25th with his wife of 50 years, Lois Eby, and his daughter, Nadine Wolf Budbill, by his side. A passionate lover of his family and friends, the woods, and all things human, he did not want to leave this life, but over the past 3 years, his progressive supranuclear palsy, a rare form of Parkinson's disease, brought him to this moment. David was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1940 to a streetcar driver and a minister's daughter. His colorful life included being a track star in high school, attending Union Theological Seminary in New York City, teaching at Lincoln University, a historically black college in Pennsylvania, moving to northern Vermont in the late 1960s and building his own house, laboring on a Christmas tree farm, playing myriad musical instruments, working for racial and economic justice, tending a large vegetable garden, cutting his own wood, and writing a staggering amount of creative material. He is the author of 10 books of poems, 7 plays, 2 novels, a collection of short stories, 2 picture books for children, and the libretto for an opera. During his prolific career, David performed his work in many venues, from schools and prisons in Vermont to avant-garde performance spaces in New York City, often with William Parker and other musical collaborators. Several new books of David's will be published posthumously, including his newest book of poems titled Tumbling Toward the End and a novel titled Broken Wing. More can be learned at davidbudbill.com. David is predeceased by his son, Gene. He is survived by his wife, Lois, his daughter, Nadine, her partner, Mia Rothline, and his granddaughter, Riley Wolf Budbill Rothline, who gave him much joy in the last 2 years of his life and the first 2 of hers. He is also survived by his cousins, Martha Cross and Dick Miller, his brother-in-law and sister-in-law, Frank and Gail Eby, many good friends and readers of his work itself, and the woods where he loved to be. His ashes will be returned to his favorite white pine stand in the woods at the home in Walcott, Vermont, where he lived and wrote for 45 years. An event to celebrate David's life and work is planned for 2017. I'm now going to play the interview from 2011. My first question for David Budbill at that time was to read from his collection, Happy Life.
Jai Dao begins a poem to sub-prefect Kuo Ki of Huokani saying, I can't help feeling for you, leaving your office work only to meet each time the dying day. I've spent most of my life pissing and moaning about never having any money, not being known, never getting to any honors, not getting to travel. And yet, for more than 40 years, my days have been my own. It takes a long time for some people to realize how lucky they are.
Thank you. I thought that was a great opening poem for this collection and the way that it,
plays out.
So how did you come to write that? And are those historical figures or are they?
Oh, yeah, they're historical figures, all right. It's a poem by Jai Dao. And I was no doubt reading it. And I, you know, the first stanza is a quote from the poem, his poem. And which made me think of my own poem, which is the way a lot of these get written. Mm-hmm. Which in ancient Chinese, by the way, was called harmonization when you wrote a poem because of somebody else's poem. So, there's a lot of that going on in here.
Which is very kind of jazz-like, isn't it? It's kind of like riffing off of somebody else.
Yeah, right. It is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The next one I was going to ask you to read is actually Everything, which you wrote after 9/11.
I actually, we were at dinner last night with some friends, and I read this. Everything. after 9/11/2001. Milkweed pods crack open, seeds dishevel, fall. Everything sweeter and more fragile now. I think it must have been right after 9/11. It's fall. It's 9/11, mm-hmm. And I saw what everybody sees: those milkweed pods that are coming apart, and the seeds are falling down. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of the Twin Towers. So, mm-hmm. Anyway.
I loved the poem, and particularly reading over your collection yesterday in preparation for talking to you today, yesterday being 9/11,
right.
2011. And I felt like I would so much rather spend time reading that poem than turning on the TV yesterday.
Right.
And I wondered, what was your reaction to
yesterday?
Well,
I had a really negative reaction. I don't watch television much at all, just Jon Stewart, that's all. Anyway, I did listen to the radio some, and NPR just was endless. I mean, they just went on from morning till night, and I just, I mean, I kept turning it off. I don't know, we had just been in Maine with a friend of ours who's a historian, and with people who are probably more conservative than we are, and or more establishment, or more something. And I got really fed up in a hurry with all the talk about exceptionalism in America and stuff like that. I mean, I didn't talk to anybody about this. There was a copy of the New Yorker that came out right after 9/11. There were a bunch of opinion pieces in there, and one of them was by somebody whose name I can't remember, about what would have happened if we would have treated this as a police action and not declared war. And if it was, we were not on a war footing, how would the history of the world be different? And I can't get over wondering what it had been like if Shrubby, Gunner, and Rummy hadn't been in charge.
Yeah.
You know, if those three guys were not in positions of power, what would have happened? Maybe the same thing. Who knows? But, I mean, you can't expect nation states to act any differently, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it's too bad they don't.
I wonder if I can ask you to read that poem one more time.
Sure.
Thanks.
Everything after 9/11/2001. Milkweed pods crack open. Seeds dishevel, fall. Everything sweeter and more fragile now. I do think, you know, one thing it did do for Americans was make them very aware of the zen-like temporality of everything, mm-hmm. impermanence, mm-hmm. Of everything, which is hard for Americans to get a hold of because we feel so secure.
Right.
So anyway.
Yeah. There's another poem in here called Mid-October.
Okay. Mid-October. Almost all the leaves are down. Rain. Clouds make a fog just above the trees. The world colder, more empty every day. My favorite time of year.
I loved the unexpected. That totally surprised me at the end. So I wondered why you went ahead and structured the poem where we start thinking we're talking about the depression of fall, and then at the end it's like, no, actually, it's not about
well,
that.
Well, it's because that's what I feel. although my editor kept saying, every season's your favorite time of the year. You're always saying it's my favorite time of the year. Spring, summer, fall, winter. There are those fall days when I remember very clearly when I wrote this. I mean, I don't remember what day it was, but I think I was driving home from Greensboro and toward East Craftsbury, and it literally the fog or the clouds or whatever you want to call them were literally about 50 feet above the trees.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, talk about a heavy overcast. And it's that time of the year when everything is shutting down and getting colder and emptier. And I also like that time of the year because I was talking to somebody about how much I hate summer because...
That's right. You have a line in here about how you hate when the trees leaf and all the green comes
in. Oh, yeah, right, right. All the glut of summer comes in. Well, you know, summer to me is so busy. Oh, my God. You know, I cut wood, I garden, and especially the garden. All these vegetables to grow and then to put up. And so I'm just going crazy getting ready for winter. And this year, because we had some woods roads work done, I already have the woodshed loaded, which usually by now I haven't even started. I usually do it in mid-September, but I did it in mid-August this year. And so I go out there and I look at that woodshed full of wood, and it just makes me feel so good. And I pretty soon I'll be done with the garden, and I'll till it, and it'll be out there resting, and I'll get to come inside, you know, and not have to garden and not have to cut wood and not have to load the woodshed and not have to do this and that and the other. And then which is why I probably like winter best, because it's when I can, that's when I work, you know. Yeah. That's when I can really get down to work. But if that weren't that cycle, I think I'd go crazy.
Yeah.
You know, if it weren't work inside, then work outside, then back inside, then back outside. If the year weren't structured that way, I don't know what I'd do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just...
So it's really change is what you love.
Yeah.
The seasons and yeah. Change.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, man, I don't know. I have a friend, a director friend, Andy Doe, who has directed my last couple of plays. And he spent his life in theater in California, and ended up as head of the drama department at UC Santa Cruz for many, many years. And as soon as he retired, he came back to Vermont, and he said one of the main reasons was he just couldn't stand the lack of seasons. Mm. He just really needed that change,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which I certainly understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you like writing poems that have a surprise in them? This one I felt had a surprise in it. I don't know if it's it came out that way.
No, I don't do it deliberately. It's fine if there is one. But I'm not aware of doing it.
Yeah.
I don't think of this as being a surprise. It's just, that's just the way I feel.
Yeah, okay, great. Okay, would you mind reading, actually we're going to go to May, The Pond is Full.
May the pond is full. Always too poor to dig the pond. For 40 years, the pond site has remained only a wet place waiting to become something else. Only in my imagination do I see an acre of water and just beyond a wood duck nest at the edge of the limitless trees. And in the pond, brook trout dimple the surface, channel cats poke along the bottom. Only in my imagination do I see myself cooking catfish and trout smothered in slivers of scallion and ginger, then tamari splashed across them, popping in the wok's hot oil and out onto the platter. Only in my imagination do I see myself floating in a boat or swimming among caddisfly, dragonfly, mayfly, or sitting on the bank watching the water, knowing an inner calm as peaceful, as still as the quiet water. All this only in a dream.
Thanks. That I love that, and I it reminded me a little bit of a quote from a review of your work by the LA Daily News, and they said that David Budbill's language is so precise and descriptive, you will know immediately that you are soul deep in something extraordinary.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the importance of precision in language when you write poetry.
Yeah.
And that is just a beautiful example, just all that precision of imagined life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's easy to do because I'm just doing what I imagine, you know. I do know about aquatic insects or a little bit about them. And And this is literally true. I mean, there's a pond site right down below the garden. It's a perfect pond site.
Yeah. But you didn't say imagining cooking. You said imagining, you know, the ginger and the scallions.
Oh, yeah, right.
Well, you know, it's like you're getting so into it. And yeah. I think that's what makes a reader appreciate it.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a ton of poems in this book about food.
Yeah.
And about eating food, because I like to do it. I like to cook it and I like to eat it, especially Chinese food, Chinese and Italian, my two favorites.
Yeah. Now, do you? We were talking before about your garden. How much of what you eat during the year did you grow?
A lot. And it's not all of it, obviously. But I put up spinach and chard and green beans and broccoli and I cook the tomatoes down into a sauce. I make a sauce. In fact, there's a poem in here called Tomatoes in September about making, you know, cooking olive oil and garlic and herbs and stuff.
Do you want to find that and read it?
Sure. Tomatoes in September. Every surface in the house covered with tomatoes, a vat of boiling water on the stove, then drop them in and wait for cracks in their skins. Into cold water, out, cut away the bad spots, cut out stem end and blossom end, peel away the skin, chop them up, drain them in a colander, save the juice to drink, dump them into the other pot in which a mountain of garlic has been simmering in olive oil. Brandywine, Juliet, Cosmonaut, Rosa de Bern, all go in, salt and pepper, basil, thyme, oregano, then let it bubble while you go smell the house. Again, you know, that's all those details are just simply what I do. I mean, those are the kinds of tomatoes I grow, and I add basil, thyme, oregano, salt, pepper, garlic.
So if you write a poem like that, does it just kind of flow out, or do you spend a lot of time like picking the words that are just right? And
well, my poems don't necessarily flow out. I mean, I suppose the first draft does, but then I spend a lot of time,
yeah,
diddling and fiddling with the text, and I can't. And then I just obsess about line breaks. Oh man. Well. And I end up with about half a dozen versions, and then I have to decide which one.
Do you ever just let your editor decide?
Not so much with the individual poem, but, this book says it's by David Budbill, but it's really by David Budbill and Michael Wiegers, who's my editor. Because the original manuscript that I sent him had almost 200 poems in it, and this book has a little over 100 poems in it. So, you know, he'd say, well, that's repetitious. This is repetitious of that. And I think you could combine these two poems into one poem. And I listened to him.
Mm-hmm. Combine two poems into one. You have to have a pretty open mind to let somebody tell you to do that.
Well, I mean, well, that's true. Yeah, I hope I do. But also, there are probably two poems that are quite similar. Uh-huh. In fact, I know which one it was. I think it's in the spring section, and it's about two poems about seeing the spring beauty. It's a particular kind of wildflower, and it was about cutting wood in the spring. And it had been two separate poems. Michael said, "Well, why don't you try to combine these two?" And I did, and it worked, and it's better that way. I mean, you can't listen to everybody,
right?
But you have to listen to somebody, and you have to pick your somebody pretty carefully.
Yeah.
I'd say.
Yeah. How about my teacher?
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
My teacher, and there's an epigraph here from Albert Camus, who's one of my favorite people. I laid my heart open to the benign indifference of the universe. Which is a quote from the very end of The Stranger. Is it The Stranger? I think it is The Stranger.
Yeah.
He's walking on the beach. Anyway, my teacher. Nature is my teacher. She never asks me anything, never says a word, in her class, no assignments, deadlines, or requirements. Benign, indifferent, she doesn't care what I do. All she does is wait.
I actually flagged that one because of the epigraph. I love the epigraph, but yeah. I also was curious, you know, if the poem sort of evolved after you were thinking about that line.
Oh, yeah.
If that line just so perfectly fit this poem.
I think it was, maybe I thought about the Camus line and then thought about the poem, because the poem has, you know, benign and different.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought about how, I mean, I would love that book, and I love Camus, and I love that line, that sentence. Because the benign indifference, I mean, it's not malignant indifference, it's mm-hmm. benign indifference, but mm-hmm. it's indifference.
Mm-hmm.
You do what you want to do, and that's fine.
Yeah, right. It's like watching the storm a couple weeks ago when Irene came through. You know,
yeah.
you're just watching, it's like, it's so extraordinary just to see what we can't control.
Right, yeah, oh yeah, right, yeah. God, that's true for Irene. Whew.
Yeah.
We're very lucky here.
Yeah, you were up high.
I mean, we had a few washouts and we were stranded for 12 hours, but compared to what happened, Waterbury and South, man. Whew.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah. I actually couldn't find this poem in the book, and I'm not sure, maybe the literature was referring to another poem you wrote, but this one, do you mind if I read?
No, go ahead.
So, a pileated woodpecker will call off in the woods somewhere. Ravens will begin their croaking over near the ledges. Chickadees and nuthatches will fuss in the yard. I'll pick up my bamboo flute and join them. But just now, none of that. Just now, silence and stillness. So I was curious if you really do play your shakuhachi along with the birds.
Sometimes I do.
How do they react? Do they get quiet?
Well, no, you know, it's funny. I do sometimes, and...
Oh, is this it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's it. Do you want to read the whole thing?
Yeah, sure. Just silence and stillness. This warm September morning. No wind, no bird songs, no jets going over at 30,000 feet. But later today, the wind will pick up, a slight breeze begin. A pileated woodpecker will call off in the woods somewhere. Ravens will begin their croaking over near the ledges. Chickadees and nuthatches will fuss in the yard. I'll pick up my bamboo flute and join them. But just now, none of that. Just now, silence and stillness. A quiet so profound, I think I can hear my own heart beating.
Mm.
Again, that's just literally what happens, you know, sometimes. You know, the pileated woodpeckers are around here, and the ravens have their eyries over on the ledges, and they come by. It's interesting, because they'll come by in the morning, and then toward evening, toward dusk, I don't know where they've been, but they're coming home from work, and there'll be a bunch of them, and they're croaking and talking to each other, and they're going home for dinner or something. I don't know. I mean, they're just amazing animals.
Yeah.
And the chickadees and nuthatches are fussing in the yard. And, yeah, sometimes I play my flute out on the deck. Sometimes, well, actually, down on Wolcott Pond where we swim, there are loons.
Mm.
And I have been able to get them to talk to me.
Oh, yeah.
By imitating their calls. But I'm not aware of any of the birds around here, actually. I mean, I try to imitate them, but...
Right. They just are watching you. The loons are saying, who's that guy? What's he
doing? Well, you know, there was a white-throated sparrow in a nesting in a balsam on the driveway between here and the mailbox a number of years ago. And I got so I'd imitate the white throat call, and he would come out and attack me.
Oh.
Because I was in his territory, you know. And I know, I mean, I would try to pitch it. I couldn't get into his octave, so I'd pitch it down an octave or something. And he was very tolerant, because I know I wasn't right on it. But it was close enough that it irritated him. And I feel so bad, because I was so enamored of my ability to make this guy come out of his nest and come, and he'd dive at me, and then he'd go over and he'd sit in a tree and yell at me and then go back to his nest. And then he left. and never came back. So I felt bad that I ran him off.
Mm, well, he's somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It's just, I'd be nice, because I love that three-note call of theirs.
Yeah.
It's five. One. Six.
You are very taken with Chinese poets, Chinese poetry.
Yeah.
Do you study the poetry of other cultures as well, or are you...
Well, Chinese and Japanese mostly. I just find their sensibilities to be so similar to my own. Right now, I'm, much to my great surprise, I'm reading a book of Rilke's translations, Love Songs for God. And I don't like most of them.
No.
They're too abstract. Mm. And, you know, I keep saying to Lois, now what's the antecedent of that pronoun? You know, he'll start a poem saying, because it, you know, what do you mean it? Where's the antecedent? And anyway, I'm just such a...
Is that because it's translated into English, though?
Probably not.
No?
I would guess not.
Okay.
I can't tell you for sure, but I would guess, knowing a little bit about Rilke, that it's not. I mean, I just don't like abstract sentences, comments. I like, as it's obvious from this book, that I like to stay with the concrete facts of the world.
Right. This is what I'm looking at. This is what I'm feeling. This is who I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder if you could read, there's two poems I want you to read. One is called On Looking at a Picture of Myself.
Sure. On Looking at a Picture of Myself. Who is that old guy standing in front of my woodpile? How come he's got my overalls and chaps and my hard hat on? And he's wearing my mittens, too. And that's my chainsaw on top of the woodpile just behind him. He looks just like my father, exactly like my father. Where'd he come from? What's he doing there? He does a nice job, though. I can see that from here. The firewood is evenly cut and carefully and evenly stacked. And I can also see he stacks his brush carefully, too. He does a lot better job than I did when I was young. Maybe I ought to try to track him down and see if he would like to work with me out in the woods. He does a nice job, even if he is an old guy and looks just like my father.
I love that.
Actually, that... Somebody took, maybe Lois, I don't know, somebody took a picture of me out, you know, standing in front of one of my wood piles. And it was on the refrigerator, and I was looking at it thinking, who is that guy? It can't be me. I'm not that old. And it looks just like my dad. It's a real shock.
Only a negative shock, or is it kind of a comforting
shock? Well, no,
shock?
It's not only a negative shock. But it is a shock.
All right. I want you to read another one that's okay. Sex and Ambition.
Yeah. Sex and Ambition. Sometimes I leave this mountain home and go to the city, where I see young and beautiful women everywhere, all of them preoccupied with sex and ambition, none of them able to imagine themselves white-haired, weazened, bent, and sore. And I, approaching my own old age, beginning to know myself as white-haired, weazened, bent, and sore, I am happy to say, I am still like those young women, preoccupied with sex and ambition.
I noted these two poems because I think they both deal with aging and ideas of mortality and change. And, but I also liked how the second poem sort of turns it on its side, and you're looking at young people and thinking, well, you know, they're going to get there too.
Right.
But that does seem to be a subject that keeps you in its hold these days.
Yeah. No, it does. I mean, this, I don't know. I'm 71. You know, what can I say?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not 21 anymore. Yeah. Or 31 or 41 or 51 or 61.
Yeah. Well, if we can all still be cutting wood at 71.
That's well, that's what, you know, there's a couple poems in here about that. Because people are now saying, when are you going to quit? You know, you're going to kill yourself out there. And I have a poem in here about that somewhere. still here. Still out here in the woods, dropping trees, bucking firewood, using a chainsaw all alone, and at my age, too. People say I should stop before I kill myself. They say I'm too old for this. Here's what Yuan Mai said 250 years ago. Of course I know I'm going to die. I also know I'm not dead yet. And I love to be in the woods. And it's good exercise, especially for someone who sits on their butt all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can.
Yeah.
And it's real work. I mean, it produces something. You know, it produces heat for the house. Because we heat exclusively with wood.
Do you have more than one wood stove, or do you do it all
through
one?
No, one's that's that big round oak in the living room, centrally located.
Yeah.
It was interesting when we were designing this house. It was very easy to design a complicated house. This is a metaphor about poetry. It was very easy to design a complicated house, but it was incredibly difficult to design a simple house with a centrally located wood stove that would heat the whole house.
Yeah.
That was unbelievably hard.
Yeah.
And it doesn't succeed all the time, but mostly it does.
Uh-huh. Well, that brings me to my next question, because you were saying that's a metaphor for poetry. So I was going to ask you about organizing the poems into a collection and how difficult is that aspect of it?
Well, to start with, I had the ancient Chinese model of the seasonal organization.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of ancient Chinese books of poems are organized by season. And this one starts in the fall, goes to the winter, then the spring, then the summer, and then back to fall.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the poems are getting, they're getting more and more about aging and death as you get toward the second fall. So that the last section is really all about aging and death, and it's about the second time we visit fall. So that organization, that structure was there to start with.
Mm-hmm. Did you write poems to fill out that structure?
No.
No. Okay.
No, I don't do that. I just write whatever comes.
Okay.
But then I need to find a way to organize them, and that was a handy. And then within each section, it's very difficult to decide. Obviously, in part one, the poems about the stuff, the plants being on the compost pile, and tomatoes in September, and the 9/11, and September visitors, and then October, and I mean, there's a way. I'm going through the months, but there are also poems that aren't literally about this month or that, and they have to find a place to be, but it's. It's a little bit like a puzzle. I mean, the more parts you get into place, the easier it is to find the parts that go in the missing places.
Mm-hmm.
So,
particularly if you're starting with over 200 poems, you must have a lot. I mean, it must be harder to pull things out sometimes than to find a place for them.
It is. Also, the structure of the 200 poem book, the first manuscript, was fall and then a section about ambition, and then spring, and then a section about something else, and then so that it had, I think it had six sections instead of four, or maybe seven or eight, I don't know. But it wasn't just fall, winter, spring, summer, fall.
Mm-hmm.
It was much more complicated than that, and it's much better that it's simpler.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes I think my goal is to become so simple that I don't write anything. I just quit. Here's my new poem. How do you like it?
Okay. Could you read The Subway Philanthropist?
Oh, sure. This, again, is... I go to New York, and I love to listen to the musicians in the subways. There's some great musicians down there. There's some terrible ones, too. Anyway, The Subway Philanthropist, for George W. Bush. The Emperor of Death loves only weapons and money, and as long as he's on the throne, the Subway Philanthropist plies his trade, prowling the bowels of New York City, moving deliberately from subway station to subway station, dropping $50 bills into white plastic 5-gallon buckets, saxophone cases, violin cases, upturned straw hats, Tupperware bowls, all sitting quietly in front of electric guitar players, mariachi bands, women classical saxophonists, avant-garde jazz ensembles, brothers in do-rags drumming on plastic buckets and tin cans, a woman playing a saw, an electric organist playing Guy Lombardo's greatest hits, old Chinese men playing one-string Chinese violins, Peruvian pan pipe players, young Chinese men playing Chinese flutes, Buddhist monks playing shakuhachi, doo-wop singers doing close four-part harmonies, congo players, bongo players, cellists, string quartets, Hawaiian guitar players, and trombone players too. All of them, every one, no matter how good, how bad, it's music and it's a stay against an antidote to the emperor's hatred of all that is warm and good and alive. And so the subway philanthropist plies his trade, makes his rounds, prowls the subways, paying one $50 bill at a time, to keep humanity alive while the Emperor of Death wages war upstairs above ground in the sad daylight of the world. It's funny, when I was going through that list of players, I think almost all of those people I've listened to, except I never heard any Buddhist monks playing shakuhachi.
I wondered if you'd ever seen shakuhachi played in the subways in New York.
If I did, it was by some honky like me or your husband. The only Japanese people that I know who play shakuhachi are on recordings I have. Everybody I know who plays shakuhachi is a Westerner. And I think the reason you're asking that question is it's such a small, the sound is small and it's quiet and it's not the best place to play a shakuhachi.
Well, it's also not a very well-known instrument, this country. And so
it's
I was wondering what people would think if they saw that in the subway.
No, people are always saying, what is that? What are you playing? What is that?
What is that?
And then you say, it's a shakuhachi, and they say, a what?
Well, I had another question about this poem, which was, this poem made me... Well, actually, reading the title of this book, which is Happy Life, knowing you a little bit, made me wonder how much of a challenge is it to write about a happy life when you are a political activist and often are reflecting on how difficult things in the world are populations are underserved, and this poem really brought it out for me, so I wondered if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, there's a certain amount of irony in the title, and I also titled the book Happy Life because I'm a kind of rebellious poet, so I know very well that most books of poetry are not going to be called Happy Life. I mean, like my friend Hayden Carruth had a book called Dark World. Well, that's more like a poet's. And there's I think that review in 7 Days talked about the fact that not everybody would title a book Happy Life.
So but there's a lot of happiness in this. I mean,
there is, but there's also a lot of sadness. I mean, what I was trying to do was say. Talk about a happy life which does not ignore the unhappiness in my own life or in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because maybe that what's happy about it is the awareness of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be conscious of it. It's interesting because I wrote this during the war, and then I thought, oh, geez, what am I going to do now the war's over and he's... The war's not over, but George is gone. Praise the Lord. And then I think Michael Wiegers, my editor, said, well, why don't you just dedicate it to George Bush? And so that was a quick solution to that problem.
Was there any sort of indecision about whether to
include it?
No, whether to dedicate it to Cheney.
Oh, well, there's another one in here about Cheney. I thought it had to be George.
Yeah.
But there is a poem in here about seeing a miniature in the Metropolitan Museum of Art and thinking about Dick Cheney. It's an interesting story because it's all on a little bitty illustration of a manuscript that's about this big, and it's a picture of a king who's hunting, and he shoots a bird with his bow and arrow, goes up and finds that it's a young man.
Yeah.
He's killed, and the mother is there weeping, and so he says to her, "Okay, you got two choices. You can have all the gold that this golden bowl will hold, or you can have my head." And then he rolls his collar down and hands his sword to his servant and kneels down and prepares to die. And the mother thinks for a long time and she decides, well, this guy's got to be just. And so she takes the money. But, I mean, that kind of honor, just, oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like shooting somebody in the face with your shotgun and making excuses for why it didn't happen.
Your play, A Song for My Father,
right,
was produced last year.
Right.
So what was your reaction in seeing the play for the first time when you saw it first produced on stage?
Well, it was a terrific production.
It was a wonderful production.
Yeah, and really good acting. I'm going to get an award from the University of Pennsylvania in October, and I have to give a speech. And one of the things I'm going to say is that I feel responsible for my mediocre and my bad work. I don't feel responsible for the good stuff, because I watch, and this play is an example of that. I watch the play. I mean, I'm there in rehearsals now, but then it opens, and I sit back and I watch it. And I think, where in the world did that come from? I mean, who wrote that? I don't think I could possibly have written that.
It's sort of like seeing the picture of yourself on the refrigerator.
Yeah,
who's that guy?
Right, exactly. So I really felt that about the play. I mean, I liked the play a lot. I liked what the actors did with it, and I sure wish they could find a second production. There was a possibility in Cleveland and one in Los Angeles, and both of them fell through. But
So where was it produced? Where did it?
At Lost Nation in
Montpelier. Anywhere else?
Last summer. It was closing just about now. It was at Old Castle Theater in Bennington. Mm. And with totally different production, different actors.
Oh, wow.
Completely different. They didn't use the slides,
okay,
on the projection screens, which I didn't know whether that was going to work. I thought it might be a distraction, but I really liked how that worked out.
Yeah,
those twin screens, but that just was. I mean, that was possible because the Green Mountain Film Festival uses Lost Nation's setup, and they have these screens, and we thought, well, geez, let's see if we can find some pictures. And then I found a website at Cleveland State University with just tens of thousands of archival photographs of Cleveland.
Mm.
And
yeah, that was great.
My dad was a streetcar driver.
Yeah. Now, was it emotional for you seeing it? I mean, obviously you've worked on it, you know every word, but was it different seeing it?
Well, by the time you see it, it's not...
Right, because you were in rehearsals and everything.
Yeah, and it is somewhat emotional, I suppose, but I'm so aware of it. I mean, I'm just so intimately involved with it from the very beginning. And I'd worked on the script with the director for a couple of years, really. And I mean, there's no surprises in it, mm-hmm. put it that way.
Yeah.
But it is an emotional experience, yeah.
Yeah. The cover art for Happy Life,
right,
is done by Lois, your wife. What is it? A painting?
It's more than one. It's It is, well, this, the part in the lower right, left-hand corner is one painting, and this is another different, this is a piece of a different painting.
Okay.
And
then on the back there's a bit.
Well, the great thing, the book designer, the woman who designed this book has designed all three of my books for Copper Canyon so far. And her name's Valerie Brewster, and she is, I think, an absolute genius. To wrap this around, to have it go around the spine on the back, and then to have this part over here, it just, I mean, most people wouldn't even think to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And her sense of design is just so, and the interesting thing is that Copper Canyon Press likes to have their writers involved in the production of the book. So, last August, say, Michael Wiegers, my editor, said, get together some images for the cover and send them. So I sent him like 20. And most of them were ancient Chinese landscape paintings from, you know, a long time ago. And some of them were calligraphy by Bada Shanran or somebody. And some of them were, there was some Enzos, Lois does Enzos, the circle. So I sent her, I sent a couple of those, and then I sent a bunch of her abstractions. And Michael wrote back and said, too many! You know, send six! So I cut out all of her abstract paintings. Most of the Enzos, I kept one. And just a couple of the ancient Chinese paintings. So I figured, well, the abstract paintings are gone. They're out of the running. So then Valerie sends like six possibilities for images for, you know, book design, cover designs. And lo and behold, they all have this abstract image on them. And I thought, holy cow, how did that happen? So in other words, Valerie went back and overruled Michael and said, look, I like this and I got an idea, so... And I'm delighted.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, I've gotten a terrific number of comments about how great the cover is.
It is. It's wonderful.
And you know, it's just, it's even that my name's in serif type and the title of the book's in sans serif, and they're two different fonts, and one's red, one's black. I mean, it just, when this red isn't the same as this red, but they're both red. I mean, it's just the subtlety of the design is just amazing.
It's really yeah. Could you read one more poem?
Sure.
In the little notebook I carry in my overalls.
In the little notebook I carry in my overalls. For 2 hours I've been out in the woods, dropping trees, cutting trunks and branches into 16-inch lengths, and stacking brush. Now I'm stretched out on the fallen white pine needles, lycopodium, yellow maple leaves, drinking water, resting, looking at the sky. After a while, I take the pen and little notebook from the pocket high up on the left side of my overalls and write down an early version of this poem. Then I put the pen and notebook back, stretch out again, hands behind my head. Watch, listen, mid-October morning, 50 degrees. Almost all the leaves are down, no sound, no breeze, only now and then a flock of geese going over high and far away.
Hmm. I love that one. And a part of the reason I wanted to talk about that one was because it seems like such a writer's poem, because there's that notebook in your pocket.
Right,
every
right,
writer
right.
has that notebook in
right,
their pocket.
I do. I do.
So that brings me to my last question, which is about writing and for writers. I was wondering, what advice do you have for novice poets?
Oh boy. Well, okay. You got to write every day. It's like playing a musical instrument. You got your chops have to be up.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to practice. And writing every day doesn't mean that you're going to write something worthwhile every day. It means you're going to write every day, even if it's a grocery list. So that's one thing. And I'd say the other thing is, and this is back to Rilke, be specific. I mean, talk about the details of whatever it is you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that ought to be enough to hold
you for
about
a while.
10 or 15 years.
Great. Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Sheila.
That again was a conversation with David Budbill, who passed away on September 25th following a long illness. More information about his work and life can be found at his website, davidbudbill.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write a poem of gratitude. Consider your good fortune, even if it's just that first cup of coffee that helped you face your day, or the comfortable shoes you wear to walk to work, or the poetry of others, which makes you feel like you are a part of a larger whole. Write about gratitude. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Right now, I'm not announcing book-related events in the Bookworm's calendar because I'm not airing on the radio. I'm in between stations, but I'm going to be starting to broadcast on the new WBTV in Burlington soon. So go ahead and keep sending me those book-related events, and once we're on the air, over the radio again, I will be announcing those. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, tell your friends, and please give us feedback. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.